For the fourth time in American history, Congress has started impeachment proceedings against the president. However, this is not a new or particularly American experience.
Impeachment had been used for centuries in Britain.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we open up history class to look at the past, present, and perhaps the future of impeachment. We'll also look at the advantages and academic future of being bilingual. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Well, there is no escaping the impeachment story. It's all over the news. So we thought it would be a good idea to take a look at the history of presidential impeachments in the U.S. and compare each case against the other. To help, we called on Dr. David Kaiser, an historian who has taught at Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, the Naval War College, and Williams College. We spoke to him last year about his latest book called A Life in History. I asked how this process, impeachment, got into the Constitution in the first place.
It got into the Constitution the way most of the Constitution did, by drawing on and adapting precedents from the unwritten British Constitution. Impeachment had been used for centuries in Britain by Parliament as a way to get at ministers whom Parliament thought were behaving corruptly or in a disastrous manner or not doing their jobs. The big difference, of course, was that in Britain, you could not impeach the king. But since the king, actually from quite an early period, had to do everything through ministers, you could get at him by impeaching his ministers. And they had done that again and again. And in fact, the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors, which periodically creates a lot of confusion about its proper interpretation, was a phrase from British usage where the meaning of it was actually quite well established. And these were precedents that were very familiar to the framers, many of whom were lawyers and familiar with English law. Now they changed some things in putting impeachment in the Constitution, which was very interesting. For instance, some ministers, including a first minister of Charles I, had been condemned to death and executed as a result of impeachments. The founders ruled that out. It's very specifically stated that the only penalty that can be applied in case of impeachment is removal and disqualification from office.
Yeah, that's a little harsh.
Yes, exactly. Now, you can be criminally liable later, as Richard Nixon undoubtedly would have been if he had not been pardoned, but you can't be sentenced to anything else by our Congress. But that is how it got in there, and they knew that this might be necessary. It's not just for the president, of course. It's for the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States. And in fact, I think it would have been quite possible, in theory at least, for the House of Representatives to have cast a wider net in this case, something they did not choose to do. And we have removed a number of federal judges via impeachment and conviction as well.
Talking about presidential impeachments, it's interesting that if someone was born in 1870 and lived to be 100, they never would have seen one, and you and I are on our third right now.
Yes, that's a true and depressing fact.
Well, let's talk about the first one, Andrew Johnson. How did that come about?
Well, there were some big similarities to what's going on now, insofar as Andrew Johnson, who had succeeded when Lincoln was assassinated, and the Republicans in Congress were living in different mental universes, just the way the president and the House of Representatives are today.
Now, Johnson and Lincoln, they were different parties, right?
Well, Johnson had been a member of the Democratic Party, but he was originally what had been called a war Democrat, in that he stayed with the Union. He was the only senator from a southern state that seceded to remain in his seat and to deny the legitimacy of the Confederacy. And then he became a Unionist. The Unionist Party was created during the war to create a big tent, basically, to get everybody in who basically supported the goal of keeping the Union together. And he was a war Democrat, and he was selected as Lincoln's vice presidential candidate in 1864 for a classic big tent political reason. In other words, to help get the broadest possible support for the reelection of Lincoln by choosing someone who was not even a Republican. But as has happened more than once in our history, this is a great vice presidential selection until the unthinkable happens and he actually becomes president. Now, Johnson was characteristic of a certain type of Southern white. He was a hill country white from East Tennessee. I don't believe he ever owned any slaves himself. He was from very modest origins. He hated the planter class and the Southern aristocracy, as many Appalachian white Southerners did. But that didn't mean that he was in the least bit sympathetic to freed slaves. He didn't want them to get the vote. And he had been totally at odds with the Republican Congress about Reconstruction. And they had passed all the major Reconstruction Acts and the constitutional amendments, for that matter, against his opposition. What they also did, which led to the impeachment, was that they passed a new law, which is probably unconstitutional and was eventually so ruled, I think, in part at least, called the Tenure of Office Act, because they didn't want him to remove Lincoln's cabinet members, and in particular the Secretary of War, Stanton. Now, clearly, we have acknowledged the right of presidents to remove and replace cabinet officers from the beginning of the Republic, and this was a real overreach on the part of the Congress. He defied them and tried to remove Stanton, and those were the grounds on which he was impeached.
How did that go? Did the trial, not the trial, but did the impeachment vote and the way it started kind of mirror what's going on today?
I think in the House of Representatives, with the impeachment, it probably did. The trial was a very different matter, and a very different matter from the last two, really, because there was no dispute as to the facts. And thus, I don't think there was any real need to call witnesses. There was no question as to what Johnson had done. He had tried to remove Stanton from office. The only question as to whether that was legal and whether it was an impeachable offense. Now, the impeachment was rather gratuitous, in my opinion, because it occurred at the turn of the year 1867-68, just as this one has occurred as an election is coming up. But the big difference is that Johnson, given the way he had become president, he was clearly going nowhere in the election which was coming up later in the year. He wasn't going to be nominated by either major party, as in fact he was not. So all the Republicans in Congress needed to do was to wait out the year. I think they already intended to run General Grant and had every reason to believe that he would be pretty easily elected, as in fact he was. But instead, they decided to go ahead with the impeachment, in which case, if it had been successful, Johnson would have been replaced by a radical Republican senator from Ohio named Ben Wade, who was the president pro tem of the Senate at that time. But because of the partisan nature of it, a critical number of Republicans refused to vote for conviction. And one of them, Edmund Ross of Kansas, became the subject of one of the chapters in John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. And thus, Johnson was acquitted by one vote. They needed 36 to 18 in the Senate, and they got 35 to 19. So that was the end of it.
And there were some shenanigans going on behind the scenes to try to get some of those votes to switch to convict, weren't there?
There were not only shenanigans. There were all kinds of death threats and all kinds of other things, yes. But the pressure was intense on all of those men, right.
And then, you know, and then he was acquitted, and then he went into obscurity, and he was gone.
Actually, I believe that he is one of two presidents who came back into the national legislature afterwards. I think he was eventually elected to the Senate from Tennessee again as a Democrat.
Well, okay, let's fast forward this 100 years or so to Mr. Nixon. That one looked like it was different from all the other three.
I don't know that it's that different from this one, to be honest with you. Okay, the Watergate burglary was discovered. One of the fascinating things about that whole episode in American history, which I tentatively would like to do something about at some point, is that the question of who actually ordered the Watergate burglary and who was involved in that was never solved. But what gradually became clear was that, first of all, the burglary was part of a big illegal intelligence effort that had been run out of the White House and that had carried out at least one other major covert operation as well. And secondly, that the leading members of the administration, including the president, had been involved in a big conspiracy to keep the true history of the burglary secret, to cover up their own responsibility, many of them. And this involved paying substantial sums of money to the burglars who had been caught to keep them from talking. And then Nixon took drastic action to stop the investigation with the Saturday Night Massacre. That disturbed a lot of people a great deal more. And eventually it led to adoption of articles of impeachment by the Judiciary Committee in the House. The full House was clearly going to vote for impeachment, but at that point, Nixon lost a case in the Supreme Court, had to release more tapes. And one of those tapes showed that at a very early stage, he had been trying to use the CIA to stop the FBI investigation of Watergate. And at that point, he was forced to resign.
It seems to me the difference that I perceive anyway is that one was more bipartisan, I guess. I guess everybody knew Nixon was guilty on that and admitted it.
By the end, just about everybody did. Up until that last revelation, most Republicans were still arguing that his guilt was not proven. But that was a literal smoking gun, that tape from late June in 1972, in which, well, there were two of them, two conversations, actually, because it was Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, who said to him, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to call in the CIA and tell them to tell the FBI to stop the investigation of Watergate where it is now. And then Haldeman has that meeting. And actually, we have a very good verbatim account of that meeting, almost verbatim account of that meeting, by one of the other participants in it. And then after that, he went back to Nixon and he said, well, yes, we did it. It's all set, you know, et cetera. At that point, nobody could argue for his innocence anymore.
And it was pretty obvious that he would have been impeached and also removed.
At that point, he was definitely going to be removed, and Barry Goldwater had told him so. And yes, out he went. Now, again, I think that to the extent that there's any doubt about President Trump's having halted military aid to Ukraine for the purpose of pressuring them into announcing the investigations he wanted, to the extent there's any doubt, I feel quite sure that further testimony, further documentary release from the White House would remove all doubt now in the same way that that tape did about Nixon, if we could get at it. I'm not sure that that would really affect what's going to happen, but I think that equally compelling evidence is surely there.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. David Kaiser continues with a look at the case against President Bill Clinton. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, any place. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. David Kaiser, an historian who taught at Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, the Naval War College, and Williams College. Today we're talking about the history of presidential impeachments in the U.S. Up next, Bill Clinton, whose impeachment case started with a land deal and then, well, went pretty much everywhere.
Well, that was very unfortunate. It reflected the whole Republican response to the election of Bill Clinton, which they seemed to think was against the course of history and shouldn't have happened. And it grew out of the special counsel law, which has now been repealed, and of the way in which the Republicans have managed to manipulate that law, because at one point, I remember this well, there was an initial special counsel to investigate Whitewater, and he was about to report or had reported that there was nothing there and it should be wrapped up. And apparently Jesse Helms, at that point one of the leading Republican senators, I believe there was evidence, talked the supervisory authorities to appointing a new one who became Ken Starr instead. And then you have Starr, who decided to go way beyond his mandate and to investigate allegations having to do with sex. And then you have the way the president decided to handle it, which was a source of great frustration to me at the time, because I thought it would have been a step forward for us if both he and Monica Lewinsky had simply refused to answer any questions about what had gone on between them on the grounds that they were none of anybody's business. But instead, Clinton tried to lie about it, and that became grounds for impeachment, although, in my opinion, this is another strong belief I have, that sort of offense, if you regard it as an offense, has nothing to do with the kind of thing that the founders put the provision into the Constitution to deal with.
And if you listen, I always thought if you listen to the testimony, and I have, he does kind of weasel around the words.
Yes, he does. And I had many interesting discussions, for what it's worth, with friends of mine at the time, both male and female, I think, where I said, supposing you were seeing someone from the opposite sex and you had exactly the amount of sexual contact that they two had had, and your best friend, somebody you wouldn't lie to, asked you, have you had sex with so-and-so? And a lot of people said, I'd probably say no. And I understood that perfectly myself. So I didn't even think it was clear that that really was perjury, but that's really a very secondary matter. The whole question is whether any president, or for that matter, any consenting adult, ought to have to answer questions like that under pain of perjury, and I think the answer is no.
Well, a few more years later, here we are. The current president has been impeached. It's pretty obvious he will not be convicted. So at this point, why bother?
Well, I think that when these revelations came out, Nancy Pelosi...
She wanted nothing to do with it.
Originally, she didn't want to do it. But when these revelations came out, they decided they just had to. And I get that. Now, I think that the two things he has been accused of are serious abuses of his office. I, on the other hand, am depressed that the articles of impeachment do not address the single biggest problem we face and the biggest reason that this should go forward, which is that Donald Trump demonstrates almost every day his unfitness and incompetence intellectually, temperamentally, and as a manager, as president of the United States, and shows that he is someone whom we can simply not afford to have in that office.
However,
regardless of politics.
However, that is not a high crime or misdemeanor.
No, in my opinion, it is. But I seem to be pretty lonely in that position at this time.
I'm afraid you are. I would like to ask you to speculate about one thing, though, and we're going to go back a few years to
sure.
Ronald Reagan, Iran-Contra. Could that have been a case?
Oh, I think it certainly could have been. Well, it could be a case in many ways. First of all, just that it was so stupid to get involved with arms for hostages negotiations with Iran. And secondly, that they were using money that was being obtained without authorization to fight a covert war that the Congress had specifically banned them from fighting. I do think that in theory that was an impeachable offense. Now, again, after it was revealed, it wasn't a continuing danger. And again, at that point, he had about 2 years left in office. So there were plenty of reasons not to pursue that.
All right. Look ahead. Are we going to see these every 10, 20 years now?
I think, based on my view of the rhythm of history, that within another 5 or 10 years, the extreme partisanship that has been such a feature of the last couple decades, last 2 or 3 decades, will burn itself out. to a significant extent. That certainly is my hope, and I think there's good reason to believe that that will happen. And then something like this will become less likely. But really, again, how did we get into this mess? We got into this mess because Donald Trump was elected. How did he get elected? He got elected, in my opinion, because the political leadership of both parties has lost touch with a huge portion of the American people. And thus, the whole Republican Party could not produce a political professional who could beat Donald Trump in the primary. And the Democratic Party did not produce a candidate who could beat him in the general election. So we're going to be on shaky ground in a lot of ways until our political class can once again earn more trust from the American people and make them feel that they are part of some important common enterprise that benefits us all.
Well, you have hope it's going to burn out, so I'm going to leave it right there with hope.
Thank you.
And once again, that is historian Dr. David Kaiser. You can find information about David's latest book at alifeinhistory.com. The United States is becoming more and more diverse, and that's causing it to be more and more bilingual. From the Broadcast Journalism Department at Syracuse University, Mateo Essling reports on changes that could increase the number of bilingual Americans and how this could be a benefit to the country.
The sound of a language other than English in a classroom is a common occurrence these days. People in the United States sometimes don't speak English, and if you wish to talk to them, you better know the language. In Southern California, where I grew up, knowing a second language, in this case Spanish, is almost a necessity.
Where I work, I use both my Spanish and the English almost every day. I communicate with parents that don't know any English, and I am able to translate.
Maritza Figueras is a former student in a dual immersion program in Southern California. I also attended the program, where from kindergarten to senior year of high school, we took classes in Spanish. These classes were not just Spanish language classes, but included learning history, science, and math 100% in Spanish for at least part of our education. Some students who came into the program had English as their first language, like myself. Others, like Maritza, came in with Spanish as their first language. My mom, Yvonne Essling, the longtime principal of Gates Elementary School in the program, says the dual immersion program helps these English as a second language students more than normal school would.
There's so much research that supports them learning how to read and write in their primary language first, and then as we teach them English, then introducing English reading to truly make them bilingual, biliterate.
The benefit isn't all for those who already speak Spanish, though. For me personally, by learning Spanish at this program, I was able to better speak to Spanish-speaking family members and parents of friends who only spoke Spanish. Spanish professor at Syracuse University, Miriam Barr, has more benefits on being bilingual, from cerebral.
El cerebro de personas que hablan...
A brain of someone who is bilingual is different. It works very, very, very fast. You can work on two things at once.
Es muy, muy, muy rápida. Puedes trabajar con dos cosas a la vez.
Two, cultural.
Se necesita mantener en el sentido que las lenguas y la cultura te abre las puertas.
People need to know that language opens doors to a culture and diversity, to know each other. They need to know that your language is not the only one.
Al reconocer al otro, quiere decir que tu mundo, tu lengua, no es la única del mundo.
The dual immersion program was not that perfect, though.
There were, like, issues with, like, the teachers.
I have to agree with non-dual immersion student Jessica Shaw's assessment. We had many problems with teachers, mainly because we knew each other too well. And that led to noisiness and a refusal to comply with teachers. But Jessica still believes that the program can be helpful.
And I think it's just a great thing to have. In other schools as well.
I'm not here to promote the dual immersion program that I went through or say that this is the way every student should be educated. I'm here to say that this is the future of education in America. There are more and more schools in the United States that are becoming bilingual. And in California, the diverse state where I grew up, they want to quadruple the amount of bilingual students within a dozen years. The United States is becoming more and more bilingual, and it's coming from our schooling. It is a part of America's future. I'm Mateo Esling.
Want to hear more about the benefits of being bilingual? You're in luck. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The benefits of bilingualism are more than once thought. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ana Inez Ansaldo, associate professor in the School of Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology at the University of Montreal, explores these benefits and how they can help us improve ourselves.
Bilingualism is an amazing ability. It entails social and cultural benefits and favors open-mindedness. Recent research shows more fundamental benefits of bilingualism at the brain level. We use fMRI to compare brain activity in elderly bilinguals and monolinguals during a task that required to focus on the color of a target while ignoring its location on the screen. Both groups performed equally well at a high level, but they recruited different brain networks. Monolinguals engage a large and diverse network, an assortment of motor, executive function, and visual processing areas. Bilinguals, on the contrary, engage a small and highly specialized network, including only expert areas in the processing of color. Thus, bilinguals showed increased brain efficiency in performing a complex task. Brain efficiency may become very profitable in the context of aging when cognitive and brain resources decline. It may also explain why the symptoms of dementia arrive later in bilinguals than in monolinguals. Hence, bilingualism could represent a protective shield against cognitive and brain aging.
That was Ana Inez Ansaldo of the University of Montreal. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.